Hope you've got a Bible. If you haven't, scrounge around. There's plenty lying around, sitting on the chairs just close by. But we'll need Bibles because we have Bible flipping. And it's helpful if you have the Cathedral Bible because we'll, wherever possible, I'll be giving you a page number that should be appropriate to your Bible if you've got a Cathedral Bible, unless you've got a Cathedral Bible with a little coloured dot on the back of it. And that's because it's a chapter house Bible, so don't use that one. Just check if it's got a little dot on the spine. You're going to get page numbers wrong all the time because there are two editions of the ESV. There's the Cathedral one and the chapter house one. Anyway, go on about it, you net. Tonight we're going to run through, as you can see on outline, 10 points. 10 points about sin. So whether we use the word or not, our aim is to try and understand what the concept of the Bible is about sin. That'll help us understanding what God has done for us in Christ Jesus, but it'll also help us to explain the gospel more clearly to our neighbours and friends and to visitors who come to the cathedral, and if you're a visitor to the cathedral, to help you tonight understand what we mean by this concept. For many people mishear the word. They hear us say the word, but their concept of sin is so different to the concept of the Bible, they misunderstand Christians. And then Christians keep on talking because we assume that they've thought about the word the way we've thought about the word, and in fact we're talking on cross purposes. So we need to work out what this word sin, or rather than just the word, what the concept of sin is. And the first point to make is sin is distinctive to Christianity, or to Judaism and Christianity, to the Bible, shall I say. Buddhists don't have a sense of sin in any concept that we have, neither do Hindus. Atheists deny the existence of sin just as fiercely as they deny the existence of God. And Islam has a different view of sin than Christianity does. So the biblical view and the concept I'm talking about is a distinctive idea of Christianity. It's a particular idea that our community, because it is Christianized, still has the word. It's still out there in the world. You can use the word and people think they know what you're talking about. But because we've moved away from the Bible, in fact, our community doesn't understand what the word is really about and certainly don't get the feeling for what the word is about. So dictionaries, for example, dictionaries don't define a word. Dictionaries describe how the word is being used today. And the dictionaries, the Ian Carter one on my computer, but they all run much the same, says to sin is to knowingly do wrong, to commit a sin, especially by knowingly violating the law or teachings of a religion, to commit shameful offence, to commit a serious moral or ethical offence. That sounds all pretty good, doesn't it? It's actually how the word is used in Australia today and in America, because Ian Carter's an American dictionary, of course, but it's not actually what the Bible is saying. You'll notice, for example, there's no reference to God in that definition of sin. There is to religion. But the different religions have quite different concepts of sin, and some religions like Buddhism don't have them at all. So what is it that is spoken of here? So much is the difficulty that many Christian evangelists, people who want to explain the gospel to others, have given up using the word, and quite rightly so. I can appreciate and understand it. Our dear friend John Chapman, way back in the 70s, decided to get rid of the word sin and to call it rebellion. It's a much better word. It's a little bit more complicated to spell, but spelling never worried John Chapman. And so he was told by his second-class teacher that his spelling was no longer bad. It was irredeemable. So Here is rebellion. That's a better word than sin to understand what we're talking about. Dominic Steele is an evangelist who's working around Sydney now, and he uses the word autonomy. It's a good word, autonomy. Unfortunately, most people don't understand what it means. But at least they know they don't understand what it means, which is better than sin because they think they do know what that means. Autonomy is a simple word even in its derivation. Auto means self, like an automobile is a mobile that just travels by itself. Auto is self. Nomos means law, and so it is self-law, self-rule, self-determination, self-government. And that's not a bad way of understanding sin. Now, you can use the word any way you want to use a word. Alice in Wonderland teaches us that. But it's the concept I'm talking of. What do we Christians mean? What does the Bible mean when it's talking of sin? There's no one single word for sin in the Bible. There's quite a few different words. And so in the Bible verses I'm going to give you, they're not always referring to a sin. But it's the concept nonetheless. Second point. Sin is relational. Romans chapter 14, verse 23, on the ones that are really short, I'm sticking them up or asking them to be put on the overheads for us. Romans 14, 23, for whatever does not proceed from faith is sin. Whatever doesn't proceed from trusting God is sin. If you're acting out of some motivation other than trusting God, it's sin. You say, well, what if I do a really nice thing? I help a little old lady across the road. Who wants to go across the road? No point helping little old ladies across the road who don't want to go across the road. That's naughty. But if I'm doing a good thing like helping this little lady across the road, is that sin? I'm doing it because I want to help little old ladies. I'm doing it because I like to do it. I'm doing it. If it's not proceeding from faith in God, it's sin. Many a non-Christian gets offended at that point. But they haven't understood the nature of sin. You see, in our first reading, Malachi 3, that very short reading, then once more you shall see the distinction between the righteous and the wicked, between the one who serves God and the one who doesn't serve God. And again, most people's concept of righteousness has nothing to do with God. Though, of course, from the Bible's perspective, righteousness comes from God. God is the source of righteousness. You can't have righteousness unless you serve God at the same time. So actually defy God, reject God, despise God, have nothing to do with God, is to reject and despise righteousness, for he is righteousness. And so sin is different because it is relational. When King David sinned in Psalm 51, he said, against you, you only have I sinned and done what is evil in your sight, that you may be justified in your words and blameless in your judgments. He'd committed adultery with Uriah's wife, Bathsheba. He'd sinned against his own wife. He'd sinned against his nation. He'd sinned against Bathsheba. He'd sinned against Uriah. He had Uriah put out the front of the... He tried to talk Uriah into going along with this and accepting the responsibility for the baby that was his. When Uriah wouldn't be ungodly like David wanted him to be, he put him at the front of the army and then just at the last minute got the army to back away from him so he'd be killed. And yet, what did David say? Against you, God, you only have I sinned. Sin is a relational attitude, or an anti-relational attitude, if you like, towards God. Come with me to Romans chapter 8. Romans chapter 8. Better get our fingers working here on these kinds of verses. I've got it on page 1137. 1137. Romans chapter 8. Romans 8. 1137. Picking up, say, from verse 6. To set the mind on the flesh is death, but to set the mind on the spirit is life and peace. For the mind that is set on the flesh is hostile to God. It doesn't submit to God's law. Indeed, it cannot. And those who are in the flesh cannot please God. It's a matter of relationship or antagonism towards God. And many years ago, for reasons that don't matter now, I attended a first-year philosophy course. And I remember the atheist lecture there, to the great humour of himself and the crowd, said something that was quite true and accurate. He said, I can get rid of sin simply and straightforwardly. Get rid of God. He said, if there's no God, there's no such thing as sin. And so you see, I've got rid of sin just by the words, no God. And he's right. Without God, there is no sin. Unfortunately, he's wrong. There is God. And so there is sin. But sin has got to do with a relationship or antagonism to God. Now, I'm spending a little bit longer than this than I'm anticipating on the other ones, because this is such a fundamental shift in thinking for people that they just don't get it. And we're going to be very clear about it. I'll try two standard illustrations I use so that you can freely use them. I've most likely pinched them from somebody else, tailored them to how I want to speak. You tailor them to yourself. The first one, of course, is the one about motivation. You see a person do a good thing. But what makes a good thing is not just the thing they've done, but the motivation for which they've done it. So, young man sees a young woman drop books outside the library. Three men actually race to the lady's distressed in need. The first one, because he sees someone, a human being, struggling with carrying a load and wants to be helpful. The second one, because he's seen this woman for many, many weeks and has been desperate for an introduction because he's been trying to pick her up over and over again, and here's a chance to pick her up by picking up her books. And so he races even more vigorously to help the human in need because he's not actually interested in the human in need, he's interested in the girl and her looks. The third one, he's in the same class as the girl, he knows her well. He knows she's the top of the class, he's the bottom of the class, and he wants some free coaching. The same action, they've all picked up books. But the moral value of those actions would vary considerably depending on the motivation, doesn't it? The motivation of your action is critical to know how to value the action. But it's more than just the motivation. The motivation must be for God. Anything that doesn't proceed from faith is sin. But it depends which side you're on. And so the story of the good sailor, who's perfect in every way, always arrives on time, always is on deck on time, never leaves his ship unattended, he always obeys his commanding officer's call, he's always dressed in his uniform perfectly, he studies hard to make sure that he can not only do his job, but the jobs of people around about him. If anybody else is sick on the ship, he's the one who nurses them, looks after them, cares for them, makes sure their duty is done, even if he has to do it himself. In every way, the perfect sailor. But when you hear that he's actually sailing on a pirate ship, you realise even the good quality of what he's doing is furthering and advocating piracy. It doesn't matter whether you're doing a good sailor or a bad sailor. The question is, which flag are you flying under? That's the fundamental issue, not how good you are in flying under that flag. Are you a rebel? Or are you a government member? That's the critical issue. It's the difference between the terrorist and the freedom fighter, isn't it? I mean, what they're doing is almost the same, blowing up things. But the people who blew up things in the French Resistance, we call them heroes. Hitler would have called them terrorists. The question is, which side are you on? Not what activity you're engaged in. Sin is about which side you're on, rather than the activity you're doing. That's the big one. Once you grasp that one, the other ones flow out more simply. Third one is, sin is rebellious, is rebellion. Third one is, sin is rebellion. Now, the second one's so important. Do you want to ask any questions at this stage? Anyone want to query and question what I'm saying so far? You weren't expecting it, so you're not ready, so I'll just give you a second more. What do you call it when you do something wrong against somebody if you don't call it sin? We Christians call it sin because you shouldn't do something wrong against a person that God has made in his image. What the atheist calls it is whatever he likes to. Because without God, you don't have the category of sin. And ultimately, without God, you don't have the category of right and wrong either. You just have the category of that's what people do. Now, I might say it's wrong. I might say, did he get away with it? Lucky fellow. But with God, it's wrong because it is an expression of my lack of trust in God, my faith in God. In the poetry of Psalm 51, David is making the emphatic point that it really ultimately is against God by saying, you only have I sinned, but it's an emphatic poetic point. Yes, he sinned against Uriah and Bathsheba as well. Yep. But ultimately, it's against God. I tell you a lie. Well, the Bible tells me that lying lips are an abomination unto the Lord, that God is truth and I should speak the truth. Yes, I have deceived you. Yes, I have sinned against you. Yes, I am sorry to have done such a thing. But ultimately, I've done it because I'm telling God to get lost. He doesn't know how to relate to people. He doesn't know how to make people feel good about themselves. He doesn't know. And so ultimately, my lying to you is an expression of my rejection of God, who tells me to tell the truth. So everything ultimately comes back to my relationship with God, submitting to him or rejecting him. Does this mean a non-Christian can never do anything good? Yes and no, to give you a kind of straightforward answer. In terms of sin, everything that they do all the time only ever is sin. In terms of the thing itself, whether it is a good thing or a bad thing, no, they will do many good things. So God says it's good to tell the truth. So every time a non-Christian tells the truth, he's doing a good thing and being sinful at the same time. Because he is doing it not from faith in God, but because he likes telling the truth. Or because he thinks he will get further up the company if he tells the truth. Or he thinks he'll persuade you to do what he wants you to. Or there's all kinds of motivations for which he's doing a good thing. But it's a good thing. I mean, the three men who help the girl with her books, they're all doing a good thing, helping a girl with her books. But they're doing it for such different motivations that you don't have the same evaluation of each. And if you do it in rebellion against God, even if it's a good thing, it's still sin. Do we want our neighbours to do good things? Absolutely. You know, we want to encourage good activities. But we mustn't think by doing good activities that people will be right with God. That's the most non-Christians think we're teaching them to be good. And if you're good, God will reward you with heaven when you die. But we're not teaching. They haven't understood sin. Sin is rebellion against God. Let me move on to that one, which is rebellion. Sin is rebellion. You'll see it there. I was travelling along Anzac Parade in the bus in a car the other day. There were two buses in two lanes in front of me, and both of them were advertising Jonesy and Amanda, the radio broadcasters for a breakfast show which I don't get, which is on WSFM 101.7. I won't ask hands up those who listen to Jonesy and Amanda, but Jonesy and Amanda were both being advertised on there. One of them had a picture of Amanda, flesh showing from her shoulder and bright red lipstick on and an apple half eaten, and the big main heading of the poster was Original Sin, and both of them had really smirky looks on their faces. The one beside it, the same couple, pretty much the same photo, touched up differently, no apple, no off-the-shoulder dress this time. They were both dressed in leathers, and though the heading this time was Born to be Wild. The attitude towards sin of our society is as Josh showed us from that haircut shop, you know, the barber shop. You sell by sin. You actually use the word wicked to mean good. Which is kind of bizarre, isn't it? It's kind of perverse. In fact, that's actually how it communicates it, so perverse to see it like that. Sin is rebellion. They're right. Original sin is born to be wild. They've actually caught it, although they don't mean to, and I doubt whether I can get those two buses to continue driving around Sydney together so that people can see the connection. 1 John chapter 3, verse 4 says, sin is lawlessness. It's not breaking the law, it's placing yourself outside of the law. It's making yourself an outlaw. That's what sin is. A sinner is an outlaw. It's someone who says, I don't care what God says to do or not to do. That's him, that's you, that's them. Me, I do what I want to do. At this point, of course, many want to then justify what they do by saying, and the things I want to do are the good things. But of course, the good things are the things that come from God and his law. But that's a way of justifying it. When the occasion comes, it doesn't matter whether it's good or not. One of the interviewers of the one of the youth of London interviewed during this week was asked, "Why are you doing this?" And his answer, "Because I can." It's a brilliant answer, isn't it? I have placed myself totally outside the law. I am able to do whatever I want to do. And so I am the rebel. Psalm 14 says, "The fool says in his heart, there is no God. And they are corrupt. They do abominable deeds." It's the character of what happens in Genesis 3. Come back there. We can't really avoid Genesis 3 when we're talking about sin. Genesis 3. I'll give you a page number. Page 3. And the serpent speaks to the woman in the first verse there. He said to the woman, "Did God actually say, 'You shall not eat of any tree in the garden?'" And the woman said to the serpent, "We may eat of the fruit of the tree of the garden. But God said, 'You shall not eat of the fruit of the tree that is in the middle of the garden. Neither should you touch it, lest you die.' But the serpent said to the woman, 'You will not surely die. For God knows that when you eat of it, your eyes will be opened and you will be like God, knowing good and evil.'" There is the temptation. The temptation is to become like God. That's rebellion. I'm going to get rid of God. God is no longer going to be the determiner of good and evil. I am going to be the determiner of good and evil. And if I want to cheat in exams, well, good luck to me. And if I want to not cheat in exams, well, good luck to me, because I determine me. I am the master of my own soul. I am the captain of my own fate and the lord of my own destiny. I run me. That's who I am. And no one is to define me. It's the declaration of living without God. It is the unilateral declaration of independence. Another illustration to help you and use with friends is, of course, the Prince Leonard of the Hutt Valley province, who in the 60s, who's old enough to remember when it happened, 70s, Prince Leonard, who lives in Western Australia in a large farm, declared his farm to be an independent province, the Hutt River province. And he issues his own stamps, he has his own government, he runs his own, it's in Australia, but he ignores Australia. Now, Australia is a wonderful community, a wonderful nation, because it's tolerated him, it's put up with him. It hasn't sent in the army to clean him out or anything like that. He's one of those kind of eccentric joys of the tourist industry. But there he has been running an independent country inside Australia for the last 30 or so years, with his own ambassador, his own embassies, he is his own country. That is the essence of sin. He epitomises sin. Now, I don't want him suing me for defamation for me saying that he is the epitome of sin. I'm not saying that he is a more moral, immoral, degenerate, depraved man than anybody else who... No, he's an outlaw. He has placed himself outside of the law in rebellion against the rest of the government, against Canberra. When you hear that he has rebelled against Canberra like that, doesn't it make you feel like you want to join him? That is the character of sin. Now, sin, having just said all that, is moral. Sin is moral. Because God is personal, and because God is righteous, then sin becomes moral. If God wasn't personal, it wouldn't, and if God wasn't righteous, it wouldn't, but he is both those things, so that when you rebel against God, you rebel against morality. So, remember that verse of Malachi 3. "Then once more you shall see the distinction between the righteous and the wicked, between the one who serves God, the one who doesn't serve him." Oh, the person who doesn't serve him may choose to do some righteous acts that are the same as the righteous acts of the person who does serve him, though the motivation will be completely different. The act will be the same. But it is God who determines that that act is righteous or that that act is wicked. It is God who determines what is righteous, what is wicked. Go with me to James chapter 2. James chapter 2. James is towards the end of the Bible, after Hebrews, before Peter, and I'm looking at page 1216. 1216. Picking it up from, where do I want to go, from verse 9, verse 8. If you really fulfil the royal, chapter 2, verse 8, if you really fulfil the royal law according to the scriptures, you shall love your neighbour as yourself, you're doing well. But if you show partiality, you're committing sin and are convicted by the law as transgressors. For whoever keeps the whole law but fails in one point has become accountable for all of it. For he who said, do not commit adultery, also said, do not murder. If you do not commit adultery but commit murder, you've become a transgressor of the law. God gives to us how he would want us to live. Don't murder. Don't commit adultery. Don't steal. Don't bear false witness against your neighbour. If you break any of the law, you're a lawbreaker. If you place yourself outside the law, you're an outlaw, but you'll still be a lawbreaker as well, even though you don't acknowledge the law, don't accept the law. That is, Prince Leonard is never actually arrested and taken into prison for murder or for theft or for murder or for theft. We don't put people in prison for adultery. But he doesn't get put into prison for those things because he doesn't commit them. But I guarantee if Prince Leonard started murdering people on the Hutt River Valley, the Australian government would put him in prison because he has broken the law that he won't acknowledge is the law. He's made himself an outlaw, but he's not really outside the law. He has still broken the law for which he pays no attention because he's still under the law. So sinners are people who are outlaws, but God has given his law as to how humans are to live. And when we sin, we will break his law. It's kind of the difference between sin and sins, if you like. The difference between disease and symptom. Most people concentrate on the symptoms. Has he told a lie? Has he committed adultery? Has he coveted? These are but the symptoms of the profound disease, which is sinfulness, which is rejecting God as God, rebelling against God as God, which will manifest itself in all kinds of different ways in our lives. And so you get that passage in Romans 3. Come back with me, Romans 3, which we had read for us. Thank you. In verse page 1133, 1133 on the church Bibles as opposed to the one you had, 1133. And it says that at the end of verse 9, we are all under sin. And then it shows that with a whole manner of symptoms. None is righteous, no, not one. No one understands, no one seeks God. All have turned aside, together they become worthless. No one does good, not even one. Their throat is an open grave. And so it goes on, describing the human character and the human nature that we are in. And it tells us that the work of the law is to hold us all accountable and to give us the knowledge of sin. I've got various diseases. How do I discover I've got these diseases? By my symptoms. If you don't have any symptoms, how will you ever discover you've got the disease? A friend of mine recently has been diagnosed with a dreadful disease, but it was purely accidental they found it, and it's actually been developing for some time in his body, but it didn't have any symptoms. He didn't know he was sick. It was only a random check being done for men of his particular age that showed he had this appalling disease. But the disease is what he had. The symptoms help us see our sickness. And so our sins show us our sinfulness. For sin is deceptive. Point five, I'm up to. Jeremiah 17:9 says, "The heart is deceitful above all things and desperately sick. Who can understand it?" You see, because sin is a heart disease, it's not one that I find easy to recognise. My heart is a great deceiver, and sin is a great deceiver. And so knowing myself is very difficult. Jesus challenged the contemporaries of his day in John chapter 8, verse 44. He said, You are of your father, the devil, and you will do and your will is to do your father's desires. He was a murderer from the beginning and has nothing to do with the truth, because there's no truth in him. When he lies, he speaks out of his own character, for he is a liar and the father of lies. He said to the woman, "You won't die." That's not true. God doesn't want you to become like him. That's why he said you're going to die, but you're not going to die. You eat this fruit and you'll become like God, ruling your world, knowing good and evil. He's a liar from the beginning. And of course, rather than becoming like God, by accepting his lies, she and Adam, we humans became slaves, the slaves and servants of the liar. He was saying, "Eat this and you can run your own life your own way," when in fact, if you ate that, you would then start running your life his way in rebellion against God. It's a lie. And sin is powerfully deceptive. It keeps promising you, you will be satisfied, you will be happy, this will make your life wonderful. You'll be better off if you do this, if you do this, if you do this. And of course, afterwards you look back and you say, "Why did I ever do that? It actually has made my life worse." Sin is sixthly captivating. Now, I like the word captivating because it's beautifully ambiguous. Things are captivating because they're attractive, aren't they? And you want to be caught in them. Things are captivating because they actually capture you as well. Now, why do we sin like that? Because of the deception? Why do we fall for the deception? Well, because sin actually is pleasurable. Moses, we're told in Hebrews 11, chose rather to be mistreated with the people of God than enjoy the fleeting pleasures of sin. And quite a few times in scriptures you'll find sin is described as pleasurable, because that's the truth. To a sinful person, sin is pleasurable. All kinds of pleasures in sinful behaviour that attract us, that captivate us, that seduce us. But notice what Jesus said in John 8, "Truly, truly, I say to you, everyone who commits sin is a slave to sin." Heroin is a captivating substance. It gives you, so I'm told, an extraordinary euphoria and excitement and pleasure. I could believe that. I've never had it, although I most likely had some form of it. Is pethidine some form of heroin? It is. I've had heroin. And let me tell you, it's beautiful. Pethidine is lovely. I kept on having gallstone attacks and they gave me pethidine. Gallstone attacks are worse than pethidine, but nonetheless, pethidine was worth having. It was beautiful. It's kind of like you're pleasurable, relaxed and happy. You're in a plane flying in the clouds, only there's no plane underneath you. Just you're awake and just everybody's lovely and you're lovely and the world is lovely and it's really lovely and it's totally addictive and destructive of your life. Just never go down that route. Marijuana is the same. More and more evidence of the terrible consequences of pot smoking are coming out to us. It's an appalling substance. Gives terrible mental aberrations to people. And I won't go on with all the problems we're now seeing coming out from marijuana. But yet, no doubt, it is very pleasurable in the first instance. Sin is like that. It is that same addictive characteristic of substance. And in Romans 3, you'll see here, we've already charged that all, both Jews and Greeks, are under sin. Once you sin, you become encaptured by sin. It's, the tangled web we weave when first we practice to deceive. You tell a lie, but in order to cover that lie, a whole series of other lies have to come into being, and you lose the capacity for living the truth. Number seven I'm up to. Sin is human. Well, it flows on from the last one, but let me stop up at number six. Do you want a question so far? We've got through here. You want to come back, query anything that's been said so far, or make any comment up to here? All on board, straightforward, simple. Okay, number seven, sin is human. Just turn over the page to Romans chapter 5, verse 12. Chapter 5, verse 12. Therefore, just as sin came into the world through one man and death through sin, so death spread to all men because all sinned. Or as it says in verse 19, which you'll put on the screen, but it's just there in front of you, verse 19. For as by the one man's disobedience, the many were made sinners. This is one that puzzles people in the Western world in a way that just shows the Western world doesn't think clearly. People think, well, look, Adam and Eve, they did the wrong thing and now I'm being punished. They did the wrong thing and somehow I've become a sinner. I didn't do it. Why am I being blamed for their actions? And that's because, you see, we think like individualists. Each person is an individual, unrelated and disconnected from anybody else. Whereas the Bible is much more realistic about human character and nature than that. We are all actually an extension of the one couple. We are the children, grandchildren, great-great-grandchildren. We are all relatives. There's one blood between us all. We are all. There is only one humanity. There's not lots of humanities, like the racists want to have lots of humanities. Bibles and Christians are always against racism because there's only one humanity, and we're it. And when Adam sinned, we were all there. Every one of us participating in that sin. We are Adam. That's who we are. In fact, the word Adam means man or humanity. And when humanity sinned, you and I were there, embryonically, so to speak, sinning. And of course, being part of the one, we inherit so much from our parents and our... Well, you can know that about yourself. I mean, why am I speaking in English? Well, it was the only language my parents taught me. But they didn't give me a choice. Why didn't they just leave me alone to discover whatever language I wanted to speak? Why didn't they ask me, would you prefer Mandarin or would you prefer Cantonese? Or possibly you'd like to speak in Urdu. They didn't give me that choice. They imposed English upon me. Not only did they impose English upon me, what's worse, it's the only language I can think in. Because I think in words, colours and numbers, but mainly words, and thinking in words, the only words I got are English words. And so I inherited my way of thinking from my parents. Just the way it is. And so did you. Now, most of us don't mind if our parents leave us a pot of gold at the end of their lives. And we say, oh, I'll accept that inheritance. But most of us are not so keen on accepting the debts that our parents ran up at the same time. That's a different thing, isn't it? But we are the children of our parents. I mean, my great-grandfather, who's Danish. Now, Mr. Bismarck wanted to dragoon him into the German army because Denmark was overrun by the Germans at that period of time. And because he didn't want to be dragooned into an army to fight against the people, and because he was most likely, like all true members of our family, cowardly through and through, he fled to Australia to get as far away from anywhere as he can. As a result of his decision, I was born in Australia. I've never been to Denmark. I know no Danish other than Niels Bohr and Lego. I think that's about the limit of my Danish. Is there anything else that I know that's Danish? Sorry? No, ice cream's not Danish. That's a sales pitch. I mean, I've got those rugged Danish good looks. Or as one man rudely said to me once, yes, big forehead, nothing behind it. It was a Dutchman who had a very low view of the Danes. But apart from that, I am who I am because he made decisions that control my life. That's how life is, friends. That's normality. You are not the sovereign individual ruler of your own empire. That's part of the lies of sin. You've inherited, as much as you pass on, the disease that we all have called sin. For it's very human. Indeed, we all have it, as you can see in Romans 3:23. Just look back across the page there, verse 23. For all have sinned and fall short of the glory of God. Indeed, from 1 John we saw a few weeks back there, a few months ago, if anyone says they have not sinned, they make God a liar. If anyone says they do not sin, they are a liar. That is, the world starts from the assumption that everybody is good and moral, and it encourages us to have faith in human nature. Whereas the Bible starts on the assumption that everybody is sinful and encourages us to have faith in God and not human nature. We expect people to sin and are amazed when they don't. Rather than expecting everybody to be sinless and being amazed when they do sin. Those of you who came in a car tonight, did you remember to lock the car before you got out? When you got out, not before, after you got out and walked away from it? I hate saying this kind of illustration because the compulsive people amongst us now are in apoplexy for the rest of the sermon and not listening to anything else that's being said. But did you lock your car? If you believe in the goodness of human nature, why did you lock your car? It's because you don't believe in the goodness of human nature. Because we know that cars that are left open and unlocked, especially with the keys left in them, are cars that have disappeared recently. That is, our expectation of the world is all people everywhere are sinful. And it's not just there are some criminal underclass. See, this is the problem they've got with the London riots, isn't it? They're all now trying to work out who it is. And they discover that some of them, they weren't Africans. And then they discover some of them actually weren't poor. And then they discover some of them weren't uneducated. And then some of them were, and it doesn't matter which category you want to put them in, it turns out there's others from another category and another category. And so they're going to go on for ages to try and work out who is responsible, because the answer is everybody. There's all those who haven't got parents, but then there's a couple of people who come from very good families. And then, my friends, it's sinfulness. One of the wonderful illustrations of it I saw many years ago was a place called Roselands. Roselands was the first shopping mall in Australia. It was huge. Now, of course, if you go to Roselands, it's still there. I haven't been to Roselands for years. Anyone live out near Roselands? Is it still there? Yeah, it's still there. It's tiny, isn't it? And fairly unimpressive, no doubt. But when we first saw it, it was unbelievable mega store. And they hadn't worked everything out in those days because shopping malls don't have windows because they don't want to remind people to leave. So there's no windows in shopping malls. I don't even notice that. I understand there's none in the casino either, but I haven't been there. But it's the same reason. You want to keep people. We got windows, kind of. And so they don't want people to leave, so they keep them in there. But the trouble with no windows is that everything has to be electrically lit, and what happens when the electricity fails? They hadn't worked that out. And so there was a blackout in Roselands in the first few months of its existence, and goods went missing from all over Roselands. Every shop had goods missing. Now, it could be that there was a very clever couple of very fast-running thieves charging all over Roselands, picking up stuff, knowing the blackout was going to happen, who obviously had X-ray vision. Or it could be that everywhere people stumbling around happened to knock things into their bags and didn't notice it till they got home. I mean, you can create all kinds of scenarios to explain what's happening, but the Bible scenario is simple. All people everywhere are sinners. And the basic reason people don't sin more is lack of opportunity. Given the circumstance, given the situation, people will sin. Number 8, sin is destructive. Come back with me to Mark chapter 7. Mark chapter 7, verse 21. Mark 7, 21. Come on, found the page number for me yet? Mark 7. 1016, thank you. 1016. He says in verse 21, this is Jesus speaking, for from within, out of the heart of man, comes evil thoughts, sexual immorality, theft, murder, adultery, coveting, wickedness, deceit, sensuality, envy, slander, pride, foolishness. All these evil things come from within and they defile a person. Sin is defiling. And the defilement happens all through your very self as a person. And the kinds of things that you do are antisocial. They ruin other people and they ruin your relationship with other people. Hate, lies, murder, adultery, envy, greed, jealousy. It's not the person you want to live with, is it, as a flatmate? You might say, it is the person I'm living with as a flatmate. But the trouble is, they're living with one just like that as well. Check out the mirror. And these things, they're all antisocial. They're all destructive. The sins that come from our sin hurt everybody and ourselves as well. Number 9, what's worth, sin is progressive. Alcohol, I understand, is a progressive disease. That is, the more you drink, the more you need to drink, like lots of addictions, in order to get to the same place you were before. And part of the progressive disease and progressive nature of it is when you knock off drinking for 6 months, 12 months, and then start again, you don't start right back at the beginning, you start where you left off and proceed on into getting worse and worse. Well, sin is a little bit like that. We read in 2 Peter chapter 2 of false teachers, they promise freedom, but they themselves are slaves of corruption. For whatever overcomes a person, that he's enslaved to. And James 1, each person is tempted when he's lured and enticed by his own desires. And then desire, when it is conceived, gives birth to sin, and sin, when it is full grown, brings forth death. We'll come back to our Romans chapter 7 this time, Romans chapter 7, and see how he describes the terrible condition that many of us, all of us, are actually in, but many of us can perceive. Romans 7, page 1137, 1137. 1137, picking up verse 15. Romans 7:15. I do not understand my own actions, for I do not do what I want, but I do the very thing I hate. If I do what I do not want, I agree that the law that is good. So now, it's no longer I who do it, but sin that dwells within me. For I know that nothing good dwells in me, and that is in my flesh. For I have the desire to do what is right, but not the ability to carry it out. For I do not do the good I want, but the evil I do not want is what I keep doing. Now, if I do what I do not want, it's no longer I who do it, but sin that dwells within me. So I find it to be a law that when I want to do right, evil lies close at hand. For I delight in the law of God in my inner being, but I see in my members another law, waging war against the law of my mind and making me captive to the law of sin that dwells in my members. Sin is a dreadful disease that just overwhelms us. And of course, it is the disease that brings us to death. For we're told in the Old Testament when God speaks to Adam in the garden, he says to him, the day upon which you eat of the fruit of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil is the day in which you die. And death is what we've been living ever since. Ezekiel 18 tells us, the soul who sins shall die. And Romans chapter 6 tells us, the wages of sin, that is, the wages that sin pays, sin is the master that pays wages, the wages that sin pays is death. But hey, that's the really exciting, pleasurable and fun sermon we're going on to next week. If you thought sin was a fairly unpleasant way of spending an evening, wait till next week when we come to death and judgment. Don't avoid the next exciting episode because it's a horror stretch. But it is a horror stretch that we're looking at next week, and we need to look at the horror stretch to actually see the alternative and how great it is. Everyone wants to pull back from the horror stretch. No one wants to actually talk about it. No one wants to confront it. I actually don't want to preach it next week either, but we need to confront it to see what the real consequences are. But that's next week. What do you want to ask, or what questions, comments do you want to make? Go. We continue to sin because we're sinful. What brought about the first sin?
Adam is made in the image of God, and God is good. Then how is it that he came to sin?
Adam is made in the image of God, and God is good. How is it that he came to sin? Sin existed before Adam sinned in the rebellious heart of the serpent. Where did the serpent come from? No idea. But he is already lying and deceitful and tricky before Adam and Eve. So sin, really, we're talking about humans. Where did the rebellion start against God, spiritually, supernaturally? We're not told. Yes, where?
Are infants sinful? And if they are, like, what happens to them when they die?
Are infants sinful? And if so, what happens to them? Yes. Yes, they are. They haven't had much opportunity to express it yet, and not opportunity to express it willfully, although if you've the parent of a small child, you'll know they're pretty willful from day one. Well, mine were anyway. I think that's got to do with their mother. So I'm sure that's got to do with Adam and Eve and the rest, but she's here tonight. Yes. Willfulness and sinfulness is inherent in a child and sins in a child. However, the scripture does acknowledge what humanly is a fairly obvious thing. That is, that when you're a child, you have a different sense of accountability and responsibility for your actions than when you're an adult. And so Isaiah 7 talks about the time before knowing good and evil. And in the Old Testament somewhere, in the first five books of the Old Testament, I'm waiting for my wife to actually help me out here, the children of Israel who sinned in the wilderness did not all perish in the wilderness, but only those who were over the age of 20. Which is it, Deuteronomy or Numbers or somewhere? Who can tell me? Sorry? It's in Deuteronomy and Numbers. Helen says it's in Deuteronomy. It is. Deuteronomy is the second giving of the law, so it's not surprising it says the same thing as the first one. That the children, so there is an age of responsibility for our actions. Now, we're learning more and more of that just psychologically as we discover how long it takes for the human brain to develop, and that most male brains don't actually develop a sense of sensible risk intuitiveness until in their mid-20s. But the insurance companies have known that for years, haven't they? Because they won't insure people under 25 without huge excesses. And the army know that. That's why they recruit people at 18, because they're the only people stupid enough to jump out of a trench and charge towards the opposition. So we've all known that, you know, lack of full mental development is in the young male brain, and I just remember there are some here, and I love you, and I love your risk-taking, and I've got some jobs for you later. but there is a sense of age, where that age is, for which you are held accountable and responsible for what you've done, and the infant is not of that age. All decisions the baby makes are made by the parents, basically, aren't they? Somewhere along the line, the decisions of that baby are the adult's decisions until ultimately that adult child will make decisions for the parents in their old age. That transfer of who's responsible for whom goes through lifetime. Numbers 14 verse 29 is what I'm looking for. Numbers 14, 29. See why I have her around, don't you? She's wonderful. Yes? Where are we going? Yes? Yes, Romans 7.
Take that as saying, yep. Phil.
Yep.
That Mark is saying, it's not my fault, it's sin.
Yes. And
some people could interpret that to be, hey, I can do what I want, it's not my fault,
yes.
It's sin.
It sounds like a bit of a cop-out. I didn't do it, sin did it. Sin made me do it. The trouble is, I sin. And so if you only had that passage, if that was the only discussion of sin in the Bible, you could possibly use that as an escape clause. But it's not the only passage. And it is that he is very conscious elsewhere that he is the sinner, responsible and answerable for the sin, because it's his sin within him. And so I can't offload the guilt on Adam. If I was there with Adam making that decision, and I keep making it, I'm sorry to say. Josh looks like he's heading up here, and therefore I'm heading off here. Is that right?